Okay. Lulav, what is something cool and queer and Jewish that you've been up to?
Well, explicitly Gentile, but a little bit ago, I was walking home from something, maybe Quiz Bowl? It's been a minute. Anyway, I was walking home and there was like a guy behind me. So I just turned my collar up and got ready to open my door in like 2 seconds. And then the guy called out to me and was like, "Hey neighbor." And I was like, "Oh, it's Brad. Cool." So we both went inside and just like chatted a bit on our way to our respective doors. And then, like, half an hour later, after I had taken off my head covering and my skirt, I hear a knock on my door. And I'm like, "Who is it?" And he's like, "It's Brad. I need some change." And I was like, "Okay, cool. Let me get a hat on." So I answer the door and he's like topless. And he's like, "Yeah, I'm going clubbing. I need some money for the coat check. Here are 8 quarters. Do you have $2?
Oh my God.
I was like, "Yeah, sure." I am always in favor of enabling somebody's coat checkery.
Great.
Especially when it is clubbing involved.
Yeah.
And then he just like looked at the piles of books that I have on my bed, and we talked about books for a bit and how we are both, quote, fashion forward, end quote, which I think was code for gay. But yeah, as I said, I am not that fashion forward. I just have purloined fancy clothing from a variety of different exes. But yeah, so that was a nice, fun experience of, like, people I don't intimately understand, but, like, cousins.
Yeah, yeah, that's lovely.
What about you, Jazz?
I guess lots of queer and Jewish things happen in my life, which is just a very nice part of my life. But the thing that is on my radar right now is at work, we had to clean out and organize the back storage space because it's kind of a mess, but that's where all our supplies are. And our supervisor told us that we were going to be doing this. And Deco, who, listeners, if you did not listen to our episode where Deco came on the podcast, please go and do that because it was excellent. Deco just sort of marched around for the next, like, hour or two, and also the next day when we also had to go back, being like, "They're sending us into the closet, I guess. We're gonna have to go into the closet. We'll escape again later." It's like,
Yes, eventually you will be let out of Mitzrayim. Spoilers?
Yeah. Also, our boiler broke the other day.
Oh, no.
And then we were like, "There will be children coming here, and the building is freezing." This part wasn't queer. It was just, we were like, we have 1 hour to figure out what we're going to do with all of these children. And we finagled it into a Hanukkah miracle.
Good.
I guess it won't be Hanukkah by the time it comes. But this was a Hanukkah thing when it happened, which is that we moved all of them into the other building across the street and watched the Rugrats Hanukkah special.
Good. Sorry.
Yeah.
I grew up when Rugrats was still airing.
Aw.
So I have a very special attachment to the grandparents from the old country.
None of these kids, I think, had ever seen Rugrats before. So it was great.
Well, yeah. At least all you had to do was use some elbow grease on that VHS. Was that the right holiday special? Did you watch along with them?
Yeah, I did. Okay. Sort of. I was keeping an eye on them to make sure no children were injured. But there was a child who's like running around trying to get the Christmas thing to work, right? Anyway.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Kosher Queers, a podcast with at least 2 Jews, and generally more than 3 opinions. Each week we bring you queer takes on Torah. They're Jazz.
And she's Lulav.
And today we're going to talk about Shemot.
We made it!
Yeah.
We finished a whole book.
We're in the opposite of the promised land.
We're in the one we still have to escape from, but we made it to the second book. We're in Exodus. We're in Shemot. Good time to go over really briefly that books in Hebrew are not named the same way as they are in English, that it's just called Shemot because the first parsha is called Shemot, and it's called Shemot because, again, like, that's one of the first words in it.
Also, it's a parsha full of names.
Yes. Shemot means names, and also it's a parsha full of names. But, like, in English, it's called Exodus because they leave. And that's not how the Hebrew works.
Yeah. So, a little history note. There was a point at which the major distribution of the Torah was in Greek Vulgate, called the Septuagint. So they gave names to each of the books. And so that's where you get Genesis, which is a Greek word, and Exodus from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is just leaving, but we're more about names here.
Yeah, I'm not very familiar with that version of it. I know that because we only have 5 books in what we consider the Torah, there are people who call that then the Pentateuch.
Mm, yes.
I think they say it with less of a trying to sound Hebrew because it's not a Hebrew word. I just don't know how to say that word otherwise.
I mean, that's probably fair.
But yeah, so I think that is another word for them.
So, given the magic of time travel, by which I mean we stopped recording and started recording again, I found out that the Septuagint was the translation of, quote, the Old Testament, end quote, generally into Koine Greek. So it's like the Pentateuch, as you were talking about, the 5 books, the Torah.
This is plus 2 more things.
Plus also Nevi'im and Ketuvim.
Oh, okay,
so, like,
sure.
The Septuagint is the Tanakh,
uh-huh,
generally speaking, and the Pentateuch is the Greek Vulgate of the Torah.
Huh, I didn't know that Christians had all of that.
Yeah, they have a lot of stuff. So the important thing is that there were Jews that were in diaspora and weren't using Hebrew as much.
And they were using Greek?
They were using Koine Greek, yeah.
Huh.
Which was a dialect common around the turn of the millennium. So yeah, that's when we see, like, Paul, for instance,
mm-hmm,
Paul of Tarsus, he was a Greek Jew, and so, like, he was mostly speaking in Greek, but also, I guess, came from a Jewish tradition.
Are these the same Hellenized Jews that end up being controversial figures around Hanukkah time?
Tell me a little more about that story.
Well,
Hellenized is the right word, yes.
Part of the story of Hanukkah, I know we're past Hanukkah now when this episode comes out, but part of the story of Hanukkah is that the Greeks come in and take over the region, and there is already a temple standing, mm-hmm, but some of the Jews around that time assimilate into Greek culture, into what's there, and they're still Jewish, but they're also Greek.
Yeah.
And the Maccabees are anti-assimilationist Jews, and they are not happy about assimilation. And also, there's the implication that later in the story, one, the Maccabees and their sort of ilk are refusing to assimilate, but also that the Greeks start cracking down more on them, that they are not allowed to be there without assimilating, and that the Greeks then take the temple so that they cannot continue to have a center of religious life.
Okay.
And because this happens at this point in time, we don't really have, like, rabbinic Judaism as we know it now.
Yeah.
The temple is very, very much the focus, and so it's just about, but that's less true, again, for sort of assimilated Hellenized Jews.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And estimates are that we lose 90% of the Jewish population around then, that they sort of assimilate into broader Greek culture.
Okay.
I could be wrong about that. It's a messy story.
But do they stop being Jews?
That's a good question.
Because my impression was that Hellenized Jews were still Jews. Maybe not the ones who fully assimilated to become, like, Greek Greeks, but...
So the number that I just cited, which I can't source, so I don't know where it's from,
fair,
is that eventually, like, their descendants ended up not staying Jewish, mm-hmm, after a number of generations, but that definitely the first few generations, like, were Jews.
Yeah.
But this is a messy story also because it's just a word of mouth story in a lot, mm-hmm, of ways, or at least if there's more legit scholarship, I do not yet know it. And the thing about word of mouth scholarship is that we are descended from the people who were very committed to maintaining that rigorous Jewish identity. identity in that particular way, who were very much like, we must never assimilate and we must never intermarry and we must never connect with other people. And so I'm not necessarily embracing that as like a moral for today's society. I think it's perfectly fine to be Jewish and another thing.
Yeah.
But yes.
This is a messy story and also a messianic story in that Greek Jews were a prime target for conversion to early Christianity.
I think so. Yeah.
Because originally Christianity was just like a dialect of Judaism, and then it got more and more spun away from that as it got more and more about explicitly not being Jewish and all that stuff. But anyway.
I really appreciate that you call it a dialect instead of a denomination, because
that that word.
Dialects are great. Denominations? Anyway.
Speaking of assimilation, Jazz, can you tell us about this story?
I super can. Can you give me 75 seconds?
Okay. 1 minute, 15 seconds. Okay. 3, 2, 1, go.
There are suddenly lots of Israelites. Pharaoh invented the dual loyalty trope and enslaved them, then tried to kill all the babies. Shipra and Pua saved them, go midwives. They lied to Pharaoh, and then Pharaoh told soldiers to go murder babies instead. One woman hid her baby in the river, with his older sister watching, and a princess came and adopted him. And this is Moshe, who was still basically raised by his biological family, though they pretended to be wet nurses and such. When Moshe grew up, he saw overseer brutality and killed the perpetrator of it, and soon after fled, so Pharaoh wouldn't kill him for it, which is confusing. Moshe helps out a group of friendly shepherds and then intermarries with Zipporah and has a kid. Then that Pharaoh dies and God finally notices all was not well with the Israelites. So God spoke to Moshe from a burning bush and Z told him to go back. And Moshe was super afraid and also had imposter syndrome and said, why me? Well, what do I say? What if they don't listen? What if my speech impediment gets in the way? And God goes, here's a script. Here's some miracles. Here's a disability accommodation. It's gotta be you, my dude. Moshe goes with wife and child, and then there is a threat to life and body and Zipporah fixes it with blood magic. Then his brother Aaron comes to help, and together they announce to the people that God is there to rescue them, and they go to Pharaoh to say, let my people go, and he says, no, go away, and punishes people for rebelling, and they say, no, it's the fault of the people who tried to organize us, I guess we shouldn't be organized or try and go away.
Oh, dang, that was right on.
Great, I did not time it.
I'm so proud of you. I was going so fast that I thought you were going to finish with like 30 seconds to spare or something.
No, it's so long. I have now developed a skill of just looking at a block of text on a screen and being like, how long is this going to take me, roughly, to like get through it? So I guess that's a thing I can do now.
Yeah. Side note, I was marveling at the impeachment debate speeches, because it was like, I yield 1 minute to the gentleman from wherever, and it seemed like they talked for much longer than we do in our summaries, but
our summaries give a lot of information very quickly. It seems like if politicians want to be like, I want to talk for 1 minute, that they should like race through that, and they don't. They say like 2 sentences, and I am like, I could have said so many sentences. I guess they want to seem official.
And also, they just repeat what everybody else says.
I know.
Unlike us, who quickly say something and then repeat it over the course of an hour. So.
Listen, I got jokes in that minute. It's fine.
Great jokes. I'm amazed. So, what are those names of the sons of Israel? You don't actually have to tell me the sons of Israel's names. We've heard them a lot. But
yeah, also I have to go remember them because they are like very minor characters. Some of them are regular characters. Reuben and Simon and Levi and Judah and Issachar.
And then we skip a bunch of minor characters and then there's Benjamin. Wait, is Yosef included in this?
No, because they are the ones who came to Egypt with Jacob. And it's like, these are the ones who came with Jacob, Joseph already being in Egypt.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and then Joseph dies, and all of his brothers, and all of that generation. So all of the characters we discussed in last week's drama, they're gone. But they have lots of children, and the land is filled with them. Yeah, but okay, so as everybody in that generation dies, so did the Pharaoh, who knew them, and knew Joseph, and knew the family and stuff. So he doesn't feel connected with them, or feel like he owes them anything, and he's worried about this influx of people who are strangers to the land, and what if there are too many of them? What if they replace us?
Oh boy.
Sorry.
No, when you said Pharaoh invents the dual loyalty trope, I was like, yeah, that's exactly it.
And he says there's too many of them and I don't want there to be any more of them. And otherwise, if there's a war, they might join our enemies in fighting against us, which they will definitely do if you mistreat them and don't make them feel like part of the land. So
a worm?
Yeah, so then he sets the Israelites to hard labor and building cities. The cities, we are told, of Pithom and Ramses. And it says, but the more they were oppressed, the more they increased and spread out. So there were still more and more of them, and the Egyptians were very nervous about it. Can we do a quick terminology note? Because now we have Israelites.
Mm.
We have a couple terms that happen here. Real important. Israelites is a term for them when they're here at this point. Okay. In the stories, they're the descendants of Israel, descendants of Jacob. They are the Israelites when they are like in Egypt and after. They are not Israelis, right? Like that's right? Like those are...
That's a different thing.
That's a different thing. That's a modern term for members of a modern nation state. That's different.
Yeah.
And we also, I think, sometimes get Hebrews, though we don't, I think, get that until after they leave Egypt, though we'll have to be on the lookout for it.
I do have Hebrew in 1:15. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives. What do you have in your translation?
No, I do have that also, yes. Okay. I do have that also, but my text notes that is probably supposed to indicate that they are of a like specific group within the Israelites, not that it is supposed to be the term for all the Israelites at this point. It says specifically that their names, Shifra and Puah, indicate that they're from a specific area and they were people who had lost their status in the community to which they originally belonged. Mm. And so that it might not indicate the same, it might not be a synonym yet.
Okay.
Yeah. But yes, I just wanted to add that quick note. Is there anything else that you wanted to ask about yet?
No, I'm looking on my friend and yours, etymonline.com, to see what the root for Hebrew is. And it seems to come from Hebrew Ibri or Ivri. I don't know what this transliteration is, but an Israelite. So
okay.
Yeah, I don't know. But like traditionally from an ancestral name, Eber, but probably literally one from the other side, perhaps in reference to the river Euphrates or perhaps simply signifying immigrant.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Not to be like, hey, how were people treating immigrants? But how were they treating immigrants? Anyway. Okay, so then they imposed hard labor on them and they ruthlessly made life terrible for them and they did all sorts of hard tasks, like with their bodies, of building these cities. They flip back and forth between saying the king of Egypt and the pharaoh, both the Hebrew and my translation, but for consistency, I think I'm just going to keep referring to him as the pharaoh.
Okay.
But anyway, the pharaoh spoke to these midwives, Shifra and Puah, and said, look at the babies and kill all the babies that were assigning male. And the midwives didn't do that because they were like, God will not like that. And the pharaoh summoned them and were like, why didn't you do what I told you to do? And they lied and said, because they just give birth too quickly. It's like a thing.
They're just plopping in the field.
Yeah. They're like, the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous. Before the midwife can come to them, they have already given birth. So they're like, we can't kill them at birth. They're born before we get there. We don't know what to do with these women.
So speaking of phrasing,
yeah.
1:17 says in the NRSV, but the midwives feared God. Is that what it says for you as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you feel about like the fearing of God versus, I don't know, caring?
I assumed in this case that it meant it to be synonymous in some ways.
Yeah.
In general, I don't subscribe to or like a theology that necessitates that you be afraid of the thing that you're worshiping.
Do not be afraid, we are in fact told.
I don't think it's a good model, but I do like the idea in some ways of being able to fall back on this idea of like, well, I am afraid of the king, I'm afraid of the pharaoh, but I am more worried about my relationship with God, and so I'm going to prioritize that.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable interpretation.
Yeah. Well, okay, just a quick small note before we move on from the midwives, because I'm very fond of them, is that it says, and God dealt well with the midwives, and they are rewarded, and we don't know exactly how, but it's a like, you done good, and they're okay. And
well, the next line is, because the midwives feared God, he gave them families.
Sure, yeah.
So that might be the dealing.
Anyway, but Pharaoh doesn't punish them, I think is also part of what we can get, that they, like, were very convincing about it. But Pharaoh instead says, okay, well, if that tactic doesn't work, I will just bring soldiers and escalate.
Mm-hmm.
And those kids that I told the midwives to kill, hey, soldiers, just throw those children into the Nile.
Yeah, it's interesting the difference between the moral weight of, like, infanticide and, like, killing extant Israelites, which I think might just relate to the higher mortality rate in ancient society, but I don't know.
Say more. Do you feel like they should have, like, it would have been more logical for him to just kill them?
Well, yeah, okay. So I'm not advocating for genocide.
Uh-huh.
I just find it interesting that instead of going after the, quote, problem, end quote.
Right.
He was like, okay, all the new boys, just throw them in the river.
Sure. I was under the impression, just reading it, that his worry was not, like, he didn't actually want to get rid of them. He wanted to continue to have a labor force.
Mm-hmm.
What he didn't want them to have was a fighting force, right?
Oh, and also it's a patrilineal society. So there's, like, the fear that the foreign men will, like, dilute your daughter's bloodlines and stuff like that, potentially.
Potentially, I would have in some ways even taken it the other way of, okay, like, this will keep their population down to a smaller amount, and we can always decide to have more children if we keep the women around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the thing that they were talking about was, I want a smaller population, and that, like, if you kill off all of the 20-year-olds, then you are kind of stuck. But if you kill off all of the babies, and then you reverse that policy in 2 years, then you would just have fewer in the next generation, but not none, you know?
Thanks, Margaret Sanger.
Okay. I'm not obviously saying that this is a, like, good policy.
Mm-hmm.
It is cartoonishly villainous.
Yeah, right?
That's why it's here.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, in terms of that cartoon villainy, I think you gotta understand that part of the cartoon villainy is, oh, but we want there to still continue to be some of them to exploit their labor.
Right.
We just don't want there to be so many of them. But I think this is never supposed to be a permanent policy. It's supposed to be a form of population control.
Yeah.
Can we just side note to say that population control in modern times is also generally evil, that when people talk about overpopulation, they imply that, like, the problems in the world that we're facing is because those people over there have too many children. And that's not true. It's a problem of resource distribution that's not evenly allocated. The problem is not the family down the street who conveniently comes from a different country that, like, have 5 children. The problem is that people in the U.S. use a ridiculous number of resources to exist.
Yeah. So population control as, like, a policy objective, horrid, not effective, and also morally bad.
Right. Bad in biblical times, bad now.
I do want to mention, because I was dunking on Margaret Sanger and talking about infanticide, that abortion should be safe and legal and readily available.
Yes, but not Margaret Sanger's eugenics.
Oh, God, no. No, she hurt a lot of people.
Yeah. Okay, then we move on to a woman has a child. We get names for neither the woman nor the child, and hides the child because the kid is so beautiful.
He's a fine baby.
And then puts the baby in a basket, so they're all protected, places it not in the river proper, but, like, in the reeds where the basket can, like, kind of chill, and an older sister comes to watch it. I always was taught this as she technically abided the rules of putting her baby in the river.
Good.
She rules lawyered it.
Uh-huh. Our people, the original munchkins.
Anyway, a daughter of Pharaoh comes down and saw that there was a child crying, and she knows that this is an Israelite child. Oh, I guess she says this is a Hebrew child. Right, so she knows, and the sister runs out.
Hey, miss.
And is like, should I get a wet nurse for the baby? And Pharaoh's daughter says yes, and so the girl goes and gets the child's mom, and Pharaoh's daughter pays her to nurse her baby. And Pharaoh's daughter names him Moshe, which means I drew him from the water. Which actually does a little bit beg the question of if he had an original name that was given by his mother, but we are never told it, if so.
I'm guessing that there is some midrash about this, that his name was also Moshe, just through some coincidence.
I would love to find that out, maybe for next time.
Okay. I will write that in Continuity Corner while you tell me more things.
Thank you. Okay. And then he grew up. We just have a time skip. And he went out and saw the Israelites working. And it says in here, like, he went out to his kinsfolk. And he saw somebody being beaten at their work. And he killed the... I sort of was taught it as an overseer, but it just says an Egyptian. And for all we know, this person isn't an overseer. It's just like a hate crime.
Okay, very important information, though. Moshe checks for pigs first. He looks this way and that. And then he kills them.
He does, yeah. But the other thing is that, like, when he realized that he's been seen by other Hebrews, by them, because he goes the next day to break up a fight between two of them, and they're like, are you going to kill us too? And he's like, oh, people know. And eventually word gets back to Pharaoh and he's going to kill Moshe. And so he leaves. He flees. Do you have any questions about this part?
I don't think so. No, I just, you know, direct action. Heck yeah.
It's true. I just want to note that it seems a little bit odd to me that he's so scared that other people who are Hebrew laborers will see him. And that the matter gets back to Pharaoh when they're the only ones who saw it.
Yeah. I mean, he's not one of them.
No.
And... also, it's very possible that this is just reporting Moshe's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is true that he killed a man. Mm-hmm. And it is true that he worried about his dad finding out.
Mm-hmm.
And it is also true that his dad heard about the corpse.
Uh-huh.
But I think that Moshe is just putting it together in a way that he's, like, extra scared and just runs away.
Yes. It does, to me, a little bit beg the question, why is his grandfather, right? He's been raised by the princess.
Oh, the daughter. Yes, sorry.
Yeah. Why is he willing to kill Moshe over it? If all he knows is that Moshe killed somebody, like, he's been raised in the palace, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, shout out over here to Prince of Egypt soundtrack. Like, he is powerful. Why is he like, oh, I killed a citizen? Now it's going to all be revoked.
And that's why I think he conflated a bunch of different facts into this.
Hmm.
But yeah, it is also possible that he's just expendable.
Yeah, it is. It seems to me to indicate that he and the other people in the palace kind of know, you know, that he's not really a prince, that he's not really powerful, that if he was not the adopted child who was secretly one of the, like, oppressed peoples, but if he was, like, their biological child, that he would be fine doing this.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So yeah, he goes to Midian.
Yeah, he goes to Midian and he meets some shepherd women who are sisters and some other shepherds who are dudes come and try to get water instead of them. And Moshe fights with them because he thinks they're being jerks. And then he helps out the women. And the women go back to their father, who's like, how have you come back so soon? So I guess we're supposed to infer that those jerk shepherds are there all of the time. But these people definitely do think of Moshe as an Egyptian because they're like, an Egyptian rescued us and helped. And the dad is like, well, then why did you just leave him there? Ask him to come in for dinner. And so then he comes in and then he just stays with them forever and marries one of the women.
And he looks at his life through heaven's eyes.
And then they have a son, Moshe and Tzipporah, who they name Gershom, which is Ger as in stranger, and then Shom for the rest of it to be stranger in a foreign land. Okay, and then that Pharaoh, who had been like his grandfather, died, and the Israelites are still really suffering, and finally they're like crying out to God, and God's like, oh yeah, I should go back and help those people who I have a covenant with. But Moshe, meanwhile, up in the hills with his father-in-law Jethro, who is a priest of Midian. Like, he did not marry into another Israelite family.
Quick side note.
Yeah.
I like the image of just Hashem's blowing about as a wind and then sees a rainbow and is like, there was something I was supposed to remember here.
Well, that's a different covenant.
Yeah, fair.
But yes, same hat. So an angel appears to Moshe in a burning bush, and the bush was on fire, but it was like still fine and healthy. And Moshe's like, that's creepy, and turns away. But God calls to him and calls his name, and he says, Hineni, here I am. And God's like, this is holy ground. I am the God of all of your forefathers. Who are these people? Like, in case you were worried that you weren't an Israelite, you definitely are.
Oh.
And Moshe hides his face.
Yeah. So, a wording thing. Mm-hmm. My copy says, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Mm-hmm. How does yours phrase that? I'm more interested from a poetry standpoint than a meaning standpoint.
Yeah, well, there is two sentences here, which says, an angel of the eternal appeared to him in a blazing fire out of a bush. He gazed, and there was a bush all aflame, yet the bush was not consumed.
Ooh, I like that.
Right? I like the all aflame. It's beautiful.
Yeah, mine is, there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush.
That's less fun and more redundant.
Oh, come on.
In a flame of fire?
Yeah, I like the redundancy, though. Anyway, my ideal line combines the first half of the NRSV with the latter half of the one that you're reading from.
Oh, I don't like the bit where it goes, and the Lord. Like, I like that my version doesn't have that.
Oh, what name does your version use for
Hashem? My version never uses that because it has no gendered language for God. So it just says an angel of the eternal.
The eternal. Nice.
Yeah, that's its fallback, which is kind of an interesting fallback. Instead of the Lord, I think, is where it usually does it. So, yes. Okay, and God says, I know that the people are suffering, and I've come to rescue them and to bring them into a land flowing with milk and honey, where all of these other people are currently living.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen how the Egyptians are being oppressors, and so you gotta free them. And Moshe says, who am I to do this? And God doesn't really answer that question, but says, I will be with you, and you'll all come, like, I'll give you a sign, and then you'll all worship together.
Hmm.
And then Moshe says, what if I come to them and say, God has sent me? And they ask, well, what's God's name? And God gives a name to Moshe that says, Eya Asher Eya.
Yeah.
Is that what it says in yours also? Or does it have a thing?
Okay, so I am who I am. There's like a note at the bottom of the page that gives the original Ehya Asher Ehya,
uh-huh.
But there's also like a footnote on the line, I am who I am, that's like, I am what I am, or I will be what I will be.
Mm.
Just like the God of being is my impression of this name.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of a poetry sort of later when you say the God of your ancestors will be here, and here name the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. There's also this line that says, this shall be my name forever. This my appellation for all eternity.
Ooh.
Which honestly, one, is beautiful, and two, if anyone out there is trying to come up with a like line that they want to include in their like name change ritual, that's a pretty good one.
Ooh.
Don't you think? It's a good one.
Yeah, I love that. Anyway, this parsha is called Names, and gosh darn, it is delivering.
Yeah. So God says this and then says, just go to the leaders and go to the elders and tell them, I'm going to take you out of Egypt. I'll take you to a different land where currently the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, the place where they're all living right now, to a land flowing with milk and honey.
Hey friends, Lulav here. You may know me from such festivals as Sukkot. I perpetrated unspeakable linguistic crimes at this point in the conversation, and as such, have mercilessly deleted the offending content. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. They will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him,
let my people go.
For 3 days.
Yeah, you're supposed to say that we're just going off for a little retreat for a little bit, and then I'll give you miracles so that you can prove that you're supposed to be leaving, and I'll make them think that you should have gifts when you leave and all of those things. So you'll be fine. That's what you should tell the people when you go there. And Moshe's like, okay, I could tell them all of those things. He's not yet committed to will, but he says, I can tell them all of those things, but what if they don't believe me? And Z gives him some miracles.
Hey, buddy, what's that in your hand? A staff? Throw it on the ground. Check this out.
And then it becomes a snake.
Yeah.
And then also Z turns his hand to scales, and then it is again a regular hand, and God is like, listen, if you give them both of them, it'll be good. And then if they don't believe both of them, turn some water into blood. That'll be good enough.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And then, finally...
My favorite part!
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. And then finally, Moshe's like, okay, look, but I can't. Because I'm not good with words, I wasn't in the past, and I'm not now that you're speaking to me. I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. I really just want to read this whole thing because it says, God says to him, who gives human speech? Who makes them dumb or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the eternal? Now go, and I will be with you as you speak, and will instruct you in what you say. Z is like, you can do it. I picked you, and I also gave you your speech impediment, but Moshe really, really doesn't want to. And God says, look, you can have somebody else speak for you, but you're still the leader. Your brother can be the spokesperson and say the actual literal words for you as long as you go and do the thing that I asked you to.
Yeah. Like, not only will I give you accommodations in the form of helping you out with phrasing, but also I am giving you the accommodation of assistive technology via your brother.
Yeah. I just talked a lot. Do you have things you want to say about these sections?
Yeah, I think it is important to note the word that he uses when he talks about being slow of speech and slow of tongue. I always forget what the vowels are, but it's the root kbd,
okay,
which is like slow or heavy or hard, just like bad at things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I just love that so much. This is, okay, this is the passage that I wrote my exegesis paper on in freshman year of college.
Mm-hmm.
For those who are unfamiliar with the Greek, it's a devar, but about a specific word and more scholarly.
Just for the sake of our listeners, that's chaf vet dalid is the root there. And
yes,
it's written here as chvad. Sorry, but yes, keep talking.
Yeah, no, I just really identified with that word. Like, even before I knew I had ADHD and was autistic and stuff, I knew that phrasing things came difficult to me, that there are often a lot of pauses, that I have a peculiar way of speech. And so it was just very important to me that there was this word that was related to assistive technology. And then later is the same word used to describe the hardening of Pharaoh's heart.
Beautiful. Good catch.
So, like, that's the liaison that I want to point out.
Yeah.
And also, I just really like disability rights stuff.
Yeah. What do you think about this bit at the end with, like, God is a little angry about it, about Moshe turning it down so many times, that when Z finally offers, this is your brother and he can speak for you, I don't know, that it's like a little bit of impatience.
I think, like, there is patience here. There's no point at which Hashem is like, okay, fine, you dithered about it too long, I'll find someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no point at which it's like, you are incapable of doing this, but you're going to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. It's like, I know that you can do this, and I've got the things that you need to succeed. I'm going to be snippy about it, but that's just because that's what will motivate you.
Yeah.
That's my drash on it. You are free to have a different one.
No, I like that one too, that it's a little bit of a, like, I'm angry that there's so many obstacles here, but I would give you an answer for each obstacle.
Yeah, it just feels like a ruffling of the hair and being like, now go, dingus.
Yeah. Okay, and Moshe goes back to his father-in-law.
Yeah.
And tells him, we gotta go. And Jethro says, yeah, okay, you gotta go. Go in peace. And God gives more instructions. And Moshe takes his wife and children and basically nothing else except for this, like, staff that he can do a miracle with, and goes back.
Mm-hmm.
And God gives him a warning that Z will harden the heart of the Pharaoh. Very inconvenient, but that will change over time with miracles. And then there is a small interlude where they're on their way back. And God seeks to kill, it just says him, and it's not entirely clear whether that means Moshe or his son. And Zipporah circumcises the baby and touches his legs with the blood, and saying, you are truly a bridegroom of blood to me. And then the killing presence recedes.
So a note here is that it is him. It's not specifically Moshe's the way that the NRSV renders it in the text. So how I'm interpreting this is Zipporah circumcises her son and then just like dabs the son with blood to be like, hey, it's done. And then the killing presence recedes just because like you can't have uncircumcised people in a covenantal task. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Sure. I think it's confusing a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have a preference here?
I think it makes more sense to me that it's the baby rather than it being Moshe.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I still think it is confusing that there's this interlude of like threatening death since Moshe is one of the few people who actually gets to communicate directly. And why wouldn't just God communicate this wish directly?
Yeah, like you didn't think to mention that?
Right, right. You could have just said, I would have done it, you know?
Also, how do you feel about the fact that the hardening of the king's heart is, like, presaged in the charge that Moshe is given? That, like, in order for good things to happen, a bad thing explicitly must happen first, and it will be done by God?
I don't know. I feel mixed about it. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about it?
I feel like when we are called Yisrael, this is one of the things that we're wrestling with. Because I just don't like it. And my inclination is to ignore that and be like, okay, whatever. That's not how things actually work. But like, I guess it, I think we'll see that the hardships lead to a greater solidarity among the Israelites and a greater fear among the ruling class, such that there is a permanent break.
Hmm.
So that would be a sense in which the hardening is necessary, so that it's not just like they go 3 days distance, but they're watched over by a bunch of overseers. Hmm. It's they go forever.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I wonder, because if, you know, we're thinking of the Torah as a living document and one that is mm-hmm. applicable, and that you think of this in particular as like, what is your model for organizing an oppressed people?
Mm-hmm.
You could have had a model of the miracle, which is just like, we ask to be let go and then we let go. But instead we have a model given to us of, yes, you ask to be let go, but that is not how it happens. That is not how you get free. That is not how you get liberated. And instead, yeah, we are given this model of first you ask, and then you build up small victories along the way as you build your coalition and your people and your like fighting back tactics. And over time, you get more victories and you show your real force and your real strength. And then only then are you able to like fully get free.
So I love this as an instructional tale about like the progress of movements and how it takes time and like coalition building.
Mm.
But I just don't know why it is phrased as I will harden his heart. Like it makes it seem like this is an unusually difficult situation when realistically this is the situation for everyone who has ever fought back against an oppressor.
I think that's a really good point. I wonder if it's supposed to be a like, well, couldn't God have just done that? Couldn't God have just changed his heart? And I think it is supposed to be a like, no, this is part of the plan. Mm-hmm. This is how things go, that God doesn't just make it easy.
I just hate that.
I know. Yeah, no, I hear you. And I, yes, I know that you're right. I think it's a back formation, basically, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't easy. And they're trying to say like, well, I guess that means God intended it that way. When in reality, like, it's just, it wasn't easy.
And like, God can intend it that way, but it's more that that is how things are rather than that it is a miracle intentionally and supernaturally done.
I think so. Yeah.
So they did the stuff.
So, yeah, they go and Moshe tells Aaron all of the things to say to the people that God said to him. And Aaron repeats the things and the people listen. Once Moshe performs the miracles, they're like into it.
Yeah.
And they say, that's great. Moshe and Aaron go to Pharaoh and say, we just want to celebrate for a few days in the wilderness. And Pharaoh's like, psh, why should I listen to God? I don't know any God of yours. You're distracting the people.
Oh, and interestingly, the name used here is the Tetragrammaton.
Whoa.
Which is not the name that Yosef gave when talking to great-grandpa. So this may just be, I literally do not recognize the God that you're talking about.
Huh. Okay, sure. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
So, but But yeah, Pharaoh says, why are you distracting the people? You all should get to work. You want them to stop working? And then Pharaoh makes their tasks all harder. They were making bricks and stuff, and they were given straw to make the bricks. And now he says they have to make as many bricks as they did before, but they have to go and gather the straw themselves. So it's harder work. And so the overseers go and say that to the people. And the people cannot do that because that's very unreasonable. So then the Israelites are upset and say to Pharaoh, like, this isn't reasonable. And he's like, oh, you're just shirking your jobs. And that's why you want to go off into the wilderness. So you still have to make bricks. So they realize their harder work is because they tried to go off and follow Moshe and Aharon. And they are mad and upset. And they turn over and look at Moshe and Aharon and say, you got us in trouble with Pharaoh, and now we have more work to do. Why'd you do this to us? We don't want to follow you anymore. You haven't helped us.
Yay, la, 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 la. Pear chick corner. We see that as soon as just a mild demand is made, give us 3 days to just chill out in the wilderness and worship our God. As many bosses do, Pharaoh retaliates by giving them busy work. And the more that they try to organize, the more busy work they are given, and the more retaliation they are met with. But think, what would happen if they refused to work? If every one of them just banded together and refused? So here we see that strikes are not even in the consciousness of the laborers.
And here we
see... And they see the retaliation as justice.
I would say that they see the retaliation not as justice, but as consequences that fall on them as laborers, that the people who are trying to organize them don't face the same consequences since they're not laborers.
Oh, true.
And they need to see that the people who are trying to organize them understand what they're really going through before they try and make them risk their lives.
Mm-hmm. Good read on that.
But yes, definitely Pharaoh's engaging in strike-breaking tactics. Did you have any questions on any of those last bits?
No.
And the last line is that God said to Moses, well, I will overwhelm him and he will let them go because there will be a greater power even than his own and it will make them go free.
Nice, nice. Okay, congratulations. We did it.
We did it. It is time for Rating God's Writing.
I'm so impressed that neither of us forgot.
I really thought, okay, anyway. The segment in which we pick two scales and rate the Parsha on those scales. Lulav, would you go first?
Absolutely. Jazz, out of 3 hours spent gathering straw that you shouldn't have had to gather in the first place, how many hours would you rate this Parsha?
I would rate this Parsha at maybe 3 hours. Maybe like nice. 2 hours and 58 minutes. Like I like this one a lot. There's a lot of really interesting plot things happening. And it's like this powerful story of liberation. I deducted the couple minutes because of the thing you were saying about hardening Pharaoh's heart intentionally, which I don't like. But I do like that a lot of this is about the fighting back against oppression and solidarity and workers and we have our first intermarriage, we have our first disability justice, we have like 4 different women with agency, so I feel better about it.
4th consecutive, heck yeah. What's your scale for me?
Out of 7 shepherd ladies being chased around by jerks, how many shepherd ladies would you rate this Parsha?
I would rate it 7. And one of the shepherd ladies has a knife. Yeah, no, this is a really good Parsha. I might be a little biased because of how many times I watched Prince of Egypt as a child and teen, but it's just a good story and it's got personal relevance to me because of the chibbutz stuff. Yeah, I love it. 7 shepherd ladies and a knife.
Yes, good.
We didn't have anything in Continuity Corner. I asked my friend Mona if she had any questions, and she did not.
Great. So questions, folks. Like, also, I promise we will include them. I will try to give people more heads up when we're recording, because I think it's hard for people since we record so far in advance. But definitely, yeah, send us more questions. Thanks for listening to Kosher Queers. If you like what you've heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/kosherqueers, which will give you bonus content and help us keep making this for you. You can also follow us on Twitter at Kosher Queers, or like us on Facebook at Kosher Queers, or email us your questions, comments, and concerns at kosherqueers@gmail.com. Our artwork is by the talented Lior Gross. Our music is courtesy of the fabulous band Brivola, whose work you can find on Bandcamp. Go buy their album. They're great. Our sound production for this episode will be done by my lovely co-host, Lulav Arnau.
Lovely of speech and lovely of tongue.
Aw. I'm Jazz Trisky, and you can find me at WordNerdKnitter on Twitter. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Lenape people.
I'm Lulav Arnau, and you can find me at SpaceTrek6 on Twitter, or yell at me at PalmLiker. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Wapekute and Anishinaabeg.
Have a lovely queer Jewish day. This week's gender is new and noteworthy.
This week's pronouns are Na and Vel.